The following may contain offensive language, adult humor, and or content that some viewers may find offensive. The views and opinions expressed by any one speaker does not explicitly or necessarily reflect or represent those of Mark Rattledge or W2M Network. Please listen with caution, or don't listen at all.
TV party tonight!
What?
TV party tonight!
Oh! We got nothing better to do than watch TV and have a couple of brews.
Don't want to talk about anything else.
We don't want to know.
We're dedicated here
to our favorite shows.
Oh, my tickets!
Everybody loves Hypnotoad!
Gary Dawg!
Clemson at Blurnsville!
Futurama!
Good evening. You are listening to a Rattledge and Broadcasting premiere podcast, TV Party Tonight. I'm your host, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And tonight, our favorite show is The Pacific. The Pacific is a 2010 American war drama miniseries produced by HBO, Playtone, and DreamWorks that premiered in the United States on March 14th of 2010. It's a companion piece to the 2001 miniseries Band of Brothers, which we also reviewed on this show. It was brought to you by the good people at HBO and DreamWorks, as I said before. This is our annual Veterans Day show. It's a little late, but here we are. And because it's our annual Veterans Day show, and because he pitched in, and because he is, as his name says, he is the history guy, ladies and gentlemen, the War Master, Andrew Graham. How you doing, sir?
Mark, how you doing? I'm doing good, Mark. How are you?
I gave you a little bit of the Adam Cole, baby, introduction there.
I was about to say, I mean, you know, as a guy who does some catch, getting the War Master tag is kind of a compliment given the Josh Barnett connection there, so.
Yes, that's also what I was going for, and I don't really know what music he's come out to, so I just immediately switched to Adam Cole, baby.
Well, I don't really know, but what he comes out to either. But I know him from the catch side of things, so
that's fair. So yes, every year we didn't end up doing it last year. I think you were out in the woods giving bears cocaine, if I remember correctly. And so we ended up having to not do
any of the bears I encountered would pass a drug test.
So we ended up not doing it. I think we ended up just kind of kicking it into a Whiskey Rebellion where we talked about war movies. But this year, we wanted to make sure we got one done, and because, you know, schedules are what they are, we're like, well, as long as we get it in the month of November, that's close enough to Veterans Day. But this has become our tradition. Every year, we like to do a Veterans Day show. We did do Band of Brothers. You came on when we discussed Generation Kill with the David Simon from the Corn to the Deuce series. And we're back again, and this time we're talking the Pacific. Andrew, there was any number of movies we could have done as triple features or on trials. There was any number of other series that we could have looked at. You specifically said, I want to do the Pacific. This was entirely your pitch. Why are we here? What are we doing?
Well, other than the completionist point that this is the companion to Band of Brothers, I think even going
does
down that...
Mean that you're gonna, it's kind of, does that mean you're going to make me do Masters of Air next?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. I'm definitely doing Masters of the Air.
Fair enough. Please continue.
Anyway, I'd say, you know, along with just it being kind of the sequential sequel to Band of Brothers, I think the other side of this is that The Pacific's a distinctly different show from Band of Brothers. And I think, you know, we'll get into that a little bit, but just in terms of feel, in terms of structure, in terms of makeup, in terms of cast, it's just a different beast. And on some level, I think it actually does a good job of actually, or maybe the better way of saying this, is that the differences in the show is very much reflective of the differences in the kinds of wars that were being fought at that point.
That's a good place to start. World War II, the European theater, was about, and help, you know, I'm speaking from a very general kind of umbrella place, so I'm not quite hitting the specifics, you know, that's fine, but kind of let me get through this. The European theater was very much pushing Germany out of France, pushing Germany out of Poland, you know, pushing Germany back to its borders. They never got very far into Russia, but that's the old Eddie Izzard joke of, you know, they got into Russia. Oh, it's a little cold. It's a little cold. It was the same problem Napoleon had. But I think in reality, it was like they pushed into Russia. Russia would just burn the state city they were in and move backwards. And eventually you get to Siberia and you go, fuck, this was a bad idea. Yes. This is no good at all. It was, like I said, it was, you know, Germany, the topography is much different than Japan. Also, it's, you know, different kind of enemy. You know, at some point on a far enough spectrum, the Europeans and Americans are not, you know, all that different from each other in terms of mentality and the way they went about things. And I bring that up because the Pacific Theater, first you have, you know, a lot. You have islands, not flat ground, you know, a large flat continent to deal with. So, you have a lot of islands, a lot of water. Most of the mentality of the Japanese was very different from the Germans and the Italians. It was very much like, we will die for the emperor, as it were. You know, we're not giving this up. We're just not going to give up. You know, it's been said that had Truman not dropped the atomic bombs on civilian populations, we'd still be at war with Japan. So
Truman, not Sherman.
I said Truman.
Okay, so I heard Sherman for a second. It's like, wait a second. Is Sherman about to drop a bomb on the South?
Yes. Wiped out all of Alabama. Truman. And so the Pacific, I think, tries its best to sort of capture maybe the futility of dealing with Japan in a way that Band of Brothers necessarily, you know, Band of Brothers, it felt more like they were just looking for that one big victory to sort of turn the tide and then just, you know, use the momentum and proceed forward. And it's a very general, very elementary way of describing what happened there. I think with the Pacific, the tenor of the show just, I was watching this and it just, you know, it just feels like, you know, the quagmire of Vietnam. You know, no one can quite see daylight in the Pacific. And so if it was getting you to the point of understanding how we got to Nagasaki and Hiroshima, I think the show is successful. But it is definitely not for me as enjoyable as Band of Brothers. So I kind of gave a preamble there. Why don't you jump in and add some salt and color to what I said?
Sure thing. And I think actually a lot of what you said there is pretty on point, actually. With the European theater, you had one big contiguous land space, so you could have people kind of continually moving over it. Yeah, they'd get pulled off to you know, go for leave or get redeployed someplace else, but you kind of had that ability. With the Pacific, you had tons of different battlefields. You had islands all over the place. I mean, you're talking like Guadalcanal, the battle at the beginning went on for 4 months. So they really kind of hit the highlight points. And so I think it gives a good point of that. And it was kind of funny because I ended up reading this watching this about 2010. I actually had a little bit of a starter on this because, yes, I brought props tonight. I actually read Eugene
Sledge. Please bang them together so they make loud noises. Thank you.
I actually read Eugene Sledge's With the Old Breed, which is a big part of the basis for this series when I was in university. And then I ended up actually reading this guy here, Second World War by Anthony Beaver. And this one actually, when you read it and you started jumping around to all the various kind of theaters and battlefields within the Pacific, that actually kind of lined up with the feeling I was having here, because it feels, I don't know if I want to say disjointed, but it's not as together. Because you're dealing with guys in different units. It's not, it's an ensemble piece, but it's not as big of an ensemble. Because really, you have three leads that you focus on for most of the series. You don't get as much focus on a bunch of the other characters. Like, probably the only non-primary character you really, or the only two you really get, is Sidney Phillips and Snafu are the only ones outside of kind of the three leads that really get some time. It's not like you had this great depth where you had Winters and Nixon and Compton and Malarkey and all those guys in Band of Brothers that you got to know as it went.
I was going to say, Band of Brothers and Generation Kill had that going for it, where by the end of it, I felt like I knew the characters, I knew the players involved. I had gotten very, you know, as a viewer, I'd gotten very close to that company. And so when it was over, you know, when Band of Brothers, they go into Auschwitz, and then, you know, Generation Kill, they go into Baghdad at the end. They liberated the Iraqis. When it was over, there was that feeling of, oh, I've been with these people for 8, 10, 12 episodes or whatever, however long it was. And now it's over and I feel a sense of loss. You know, like whenever you watch a television show and you really get enraptured by it, really grabs you. And so when it's over, you have that almost like withdrawal, you know, feeling. And in the interest of full disclosure, I did not finish the series. I only got as far as episode 6. So, you know, there's two more. It's what, 10 episodes, I think this whole thing is. Yeah, so episode 7 through 10, I haven't been able to watch yet. But I also didn't feel the connection to the characters like I did. But the only one that stands out to me is John Seda's character. But I think it's also because I remember him from Treme. So there's that
connection. I was about to say, we got to get a David Simon reference in here somehow. So,
and there it is, folks. Mark it on your bingo card.
Maybe one other thing I'll also do is to square this up, just since I mentioned it a little bit, but pulling a line from The Old Breed, just talking about, you know, some of the differences you mentioned in terms of the feel of the European theater versus the Pacific theater. This is a line from with The Old Breed. This is a British primitive hatred as characteristic of the horror of war in the Pacific as were palm trees in the islands.
Interesting.
And that's directly from Sledge's book.
Okay. So, you know, I told you when we first started here, I was like, this was definitely going to be more your thing. So where do you want to start tonight, Andrew?
Well, I mean, maybe like I said, I mean, I think you talked a little bit about John Seda and John Bassalone. So I think it's kind of interesting. So the way this series was kind of constructed is that it was built off two books, one being With the Old Breed and then the other one being Robert Leckie's A Helmet for or a Pillow for a Helmet for My Pillow, which I've never read. And then Bassalone's story wasn't really based on any other books or anything like that. So he was kind of a new figure that I hadn't really been familiar with before. And I found his story to be very interesting because, I mean, obviously I think, you know, he's kind of the most venerable character in the series. He was, you know, a Medal of Honor winner. He was interesting because, like some of the characters in Band of Brothers, he was probably closer to some of those because he'd already been in the military for some time before he went into combat. Because that was kind of that's definitely one difference. By the time that we were in Band of Brothers, they didn't really see combat until 1944. So most of those guys had been training for between 1 and 3 years at that point. So these were already somewhat experienced soldiers seeing their first combat. That was also John Bassalone.
Okay.
With Sledge and with Leckie, they were much more new to combat. They hadn't had as much training. They hadn't had as much experience. And they hadn't had been as connected with the rest of their... I mean, Sledge is kind of portrayed a little bit as a replacement, actually. So it's kind of just a different feel altogether. I think you also get... And maybe this is me moving on to the larger series again, but you get this sense that these are also more everyday soldiers in a lot of ways, or Marines rather. They're not, you know, at the time, Band of Brothers, paratroopers were elite. That was a different...
I was going to say, there's a scene in early on in this, like I can't remember if it's the second or third episode, where I guess it's the army that shows up and they have these supply boxes and a bunch of the Marines like steal, moccasins and cigars and whatnot. And it took me a minute to realize, oh wait, they're stealing from the army. They're not stealing from the Japanese. Yeah. They're stealing from the army. It's interesting how the Marines are portrayed in this. Because again, I think about Generation Kill and I think about Band of Brothers, and in both, you know, both situations, the military is presented as very professional. And yes, there's razzing, there's cursing, there's some interesting behaviors, but for the most part, these are, you know, like Full Metal Jacket. These people are bred to kill. This is their mission. I didn't get that sense from this group in the Pacific. This almost, I mean, not that they were a ragtag, but it was, your line about Marines being, you know, the dog that we abuse and then set loose.
Yeah, that was one from Generation Kill.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing, is in Generation Kill, I never got that sense from them. They seem like these were professional soldiers ready to do a job, like if you would show up at an auto plant. That is the sense I got from the Pacific, that these were almost like Braveheart. Send in the Irish.
You're a ragtag.
where the king is like, just send the Irish first, and they go running into battle. They've got some spears and whatnot, you know, but they were definitely meant to take cannon fire. They were the first wave to get, you know, to get slaughtered by William Wallace's Scots, and then, you know, then we'll start sending in the real military. This group here in the Pacific in those first couple of episodes definitely feels like, I'm gonna make a statement here, I don't know how accurate it is, but it's just a feeling I got as a viewer. Look, we as Americans want to make sure that Europe has been saved from the evils of Hitler and Mussolini, and we're less concerned with what happens. We have to fight in Japan. They bomb Pearl Harbor. You know, this will not stand. But it almost seemed like, we'll get to it. You know, like the fighting force they sent in Japan was basically like not the priority troops. You know, like the best, most, you know, well-trained, most important troops got sent into Europe because that was the most important ground worth saving. Fighting in Japan, it was just like, just get started. We'll catch up later with the real army and the real military later on. But right now, just kind of get in there and get chopped to bits. Like, that's the feeling I got watching the show.
You're not entirely wrong.
Okay.
So from an actual, so that's actually a bit of policy. So that was actually called the Germany First policy. That mm-hmm. was always to be the focus. And that was kind of what was going on, was that a lot of the focus was trying to beat Germany first because they were perceived as the bigger threat. They were, you know, sure, 100 miles away from England, so they could take that very easily.
Can we pause there? So people understand geography. If Hitler wins the entire continent of Europe and Mussolini, if Hitler and Mussolini win, they lose an entire continent to the enemy and parts of Africa. If Japan, in order for Japan to win, they have to mobilize their troops all the way across the Pacific. And I'm not entirely sure. I mean, the theory is Japan would have kept coming. They'd eventually landed in California if we let them. But that's, I think the initial strategy of Japan was get the fuck out of Pearl Harbor. You know, get out of Hawaii.
They were looking for the first round knockout. They wanted Pearl Harbor and everything to happen in December 1941 to be hit so hard and so fast that basically mm-hmm. the Allies would say, we don't want another piece of this. Take it.
Right. I think that's the thing. You know, would they eventually have crossed the horizon into California? Maybe. But I think there's an argument to say that Japan would have settled for just get the white man out of the Pacific. You know, no Philippines, no Hawaii, no Australia. It all belongs to the Japanese. China belongs to the Japanese. Everyone get the fuck out. And in order for Japan to have, mounted a land attack against the United States, they would have had to cross the Pacific, mobilize their troops, and land a fighting force on the West Coast. Would that likely have happened? Not really, because by the 40s we still had a formidable navy. You know, within miles of getting anywhere near the West Coast, if we had given up, you know, our place in the Pacific, we would have annihilated any army that would have gotten close to us. The likelihood of a mounted land invasion of California or any part of the West Coast was not really high or believable. Yeah. So the difference side, being,
you mentioned it, Australia was under threat.
Yeah. So, but on the flip side of that, that meant, you know, it's one thing to have mobilized your military in Europe and, you know, and create supply lines, because again, once you push the Germans out of France, you had France as a staging ground. You push the Germans out of England, you had England as a staging ground. You beat back, Italy out of Africa, you have a place to land and store troops and create supply lines. The fuck are you going to do in Japan? The series of islands. Japan is not a easy place to stage a invasion from, nor is it an easy place to create an invasion force and create those supply lines in. And that also becomes evident in the Pacific as they're talking about, like, we don't have supplies. We don't have anything that we need. You've essentially sent in you sent in meat to get hammered with nothing to, with nothing to save us. Like, we'll do the job as best we can, but this is going to be an uphill struggle. And I went through all of that for anyone listening to this who just kind of casually listened to our podcast. That is the world we're living in the Pacific. It's that it's not likely the Japanese are going to come fight us on our own turf, and we have to fight them on theirs. And that's not easy either. It would have been easier to fight China at that point than it would have been to fight Japan, just in terms of topography.
Oh, China's pretty topographically challenging, so not entirely. I mean, I think there's probably a couple points I want to address there. So
yeah, sure.
I'd say, yeah, you definitely picked up on the equipping of the Marines at the time. These were like frontline infantry divisions, and the Marines. And just to maybe address the generation kill thing first, the Marines in that show were always bitching about being under-equipped. We don't have the right lubricant for our weapons. We don't have enough batteries. We don't have any of that stuff. And the Marines have always been somewhat by design, somewhat by benign neglect, kind of a little underfunded, a little under-operated in a lot of ways. And that's kind of shown in the first couple episodes where the Marines show up on Guadalcanal. And it's like their machine guns that, and a lot of the guys in the show are part of heavy weapons companies. So they machines, mortars, stuff like that. So the machine guns they're carrying are literally machine guns from the First World War. I think they're like M1913s or something like that. And then they've got like the M1903 Springfield, which is a bolt action rifle. And that's also mildly institutional because the Marines, among all things, value rifle accuracy, and they probably had, there was probably some level of institutional pushback to say, no, we don't want this new damn semi-automatic weapon. We want our good, reliable, accurate, shoot the wings off a fly at 300 yards, M1903 Springfield. So there's a little bit of that. In terms of kind of some of the bigger strategic concerns and the psychology behind how the Pacific was fought, you had space for time that you could trade with. And that's kind of a term that comes up in military strategy where you had the ability to, the Pacific was really about either fighting to stop the Japanese from advancing. And that's what Guadalcanal was about. So basically you stop Guadalcanal and the Solomon Islands, because if the Japanese could establish themselves there, they could then jump to Australia. And that would be bad because again, that was kind of the closest overall friendly landmass that the Americans could work off of. And then other than that, they were often just trying to get generally closer to the Japanese homeland to set up for what everyone thought was going to be the eventual actual invasion, or they were trying to get lands close enough that they could launch strategic bombers from. So like B-17s and eventually the B-29s. So those were kind of the two things that they were fighting for, was basically staging points and airfields.
I don't know what was next on your agenda, but one thing that rang out of the show, there were two points that kind of going into this that I was going to address and let you mostly fill in with stuff that was important to you. But the Lucky character,
yes.
There's a bit where they've been fighting for some time. They're pulled out, they get a break, they're rotated out, I guess, and they're in Australia. And then let's not forget, this is not a documentary. This is a drama. And so there's some soapiness to it. And there was more soapiness to this show than there was Band of Brothers, which I'm not going to lie, kind of irritated me. Like, I would never in a million, if I love you like a brother, I would never in a million years be like, why are you making me watch this, Andrew? But I definitely...
I'll find one of those one day.
Shouldn't be your goal. I struggled with this one a little bit more than anything else that we've done in terms of keeping my interest. And not because I'm not interested in the subject matter, but because we take this long time out to deal with Lucky and this Australian family that he's living with and this girl that he's dating. And he said something to him where, you know, there were times where I'm watching it and I'm on my phone. There are times I'm watching it. I'm at my computer. There are times I'm just watching it and I'm paying attention. And I remember I was doing something and she was just like, I'm not going to have a baby with you. And, you know, and this guy's like ready to like marry her. And, you know, like he has fallen head over heels. And she's just kind of gives him the I like you as a friend thing. You know, like we're good to be FWBs, but like I'm not really, well, I'm not wanting to be your wife. And I was like, huh, even in the 40s. Like I sympathize, brother. But yeah, I wasn't. It's weird. I know when we talk Generation Kill and Band of Brothers, sometimes I would lose track of who I was watching because, you know, costuming. That everyone's dressed like soldiers, and a lot of the battlefield stuff tends to be a little samey, which is fine. It is what it is, and I kind of like that about it. But still, sometimes I lose track of things. And here, there's not as much fighting the Japs as I would have liked to have seen in a show called The Pacific, at least in the first 4 or 5 episodes.
Yeah, and let me just pull up the episodes just because I can kind of jog my memory as to what happened. So, I mean, yeah, Guadalcanal was definitely a lot of because they had the Battle of Alligator Creek there, which was pretty, So Battle of Alligator Creek in part one, that was pretty remarkable. Part two was damn near all fighting. Part three was, like you said, Melbourne. So Bastalone gets his Medal of Honor. Lecky goes out with the Greek girl. Part four was...
They were Greek. Okay. They were Greeks living in Australia. Because I was like, are they... Okay, they have to be in Greece. I'm like, wow, they pulled them way far out. They sent them to the Mediterranean. And then I realized they were in Australia.
Completely odd and random fact. Apparently, Australia has the largest Greek expat population in the world.
I would love to know why. Not right now, though.
I can do it to you. I can give it to you in 2 seconds.
Oh, well, if you're going to be quick about it, big boy.
Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome. Look, if I don't make every one of these shows a little sexually uncomfortable, I don't know what we're doing here anymore.
That's fair. Come for the conversation. Stay for the sexual uncomfortableness. All right. Short answer on that one. So World War One, there was the, and I think they even mentioned it. The Brits tried to end out the Germans by going through a place called Gallipoli. And those were all fought in Turkey. And there's a whole bunch of complications there. But basically, they were in kind of Greece and that area as well. And I guess that was mainly Australian and New Zealand soldiers who fought that. And because at that point, the Greeks had enough and wanted to leave, they said, hey, these Australians and New Zealanders seem pretty great. Let's move there.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, so it was kind of a, I don't know why, but I mean, maybe it was also just relatively closer. Also, I've heard Australia is awesome. So it's like the weather's nice. So may as well move to a nice place.
Isn't like large portions of Australia trying to kill you at any given time?
Is, but everyone goes swimming on Christmas Day, so I don't suppose you can totally complain about that.
Okay. Andrew, what's next on your agenda?
I was just going through that one. You know, I think one thing this series gets into quite a bit, and I think that almost goes to a little bit of what you were talking about, was and maybe I'll just this point really quick and get to where I was going to, like, this show is a tough watch. Like, going through, I think, like, episodes 5 and 6 is a tough watch. You didn't see episode 9. Episode 9 is a really hard watch in terms of the outright gore, but just sometimes the misery it's portraying and the kind of war this was. And maybe we'll leave it at that, because 9 gets ugly because there's a lot of civilians involved.
But we never got to talk about it. But we were going to talk. We were going to do a triple feature that included like Hamburger Hill.
Yes.
I'm guessing you mean in terms of like just the grinder that portrayals of war sometimes look like, where, you know, I was thinking about like the end of Platoon, where, you know, they're walking into sniper fire, that kind of thing. You know, the opening to the invasion of D-Day, the invasion of Normandy, where soldiers are just running into gunfire, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, on some level, there's almost, when you look at something, and from things I've read and things I've studied, this is all secondhand. I claim to have no firsthand knowledge on any of this.
Sure.
To some degree, I can say that, thankfully. But it's like, when you, there are two kinds of stress that I think affect people when you're looking at war. Mm-hmm. It's either the direct, you're taking fire, you're in a fight, you're being shelled, what have you. Then there's the potential worry. And like, let's say in Europe, you very much always had a front line and a rear line. There wasn't a whole, you knew when you were in the zone and you knew when you were out of it. And right. in the Pacific, that was just a fundamentally different piece. Because once you got in there, you never had a moment's rest.
I was also thinking about...
you never knew when things were not only going to end for you suddenly, but quite honestly, brutally. Because if, especially in the later parts when the Imperial Japanese really went to like very much guerrilla tactics and would snatch guys out of foxholes, it did not end well for them. They weren't taking prisoners. They were taking people to torture.
What I was trying to interject was one of the things about Generation Kill was that if the guys got in a pretty bad firefight, they could call on air support. There were, you know, there was an Air Force base relatively close in the Middle East at any given time. You know, they could fly out of Kuwait. They could fly out of Abu Dhabi.
They're carriers.
I think. Yeah. I want to say, I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but I could have sworn we had a an air presence in Saudi Arabia. Okay. So there's at least a horseshoe around Iraq to where, you know, at any given time while you're fighting in this relatively small country by comparison, if you were caught in a firefight, you could call on air support and just wipe out your fucking enemy. I know that was a big thing in Afghanistan. You know, where, you know, if you just suddenly found yourself surrounded by Taliban on all sides, just fucking come and bomb the place.
That was the problem. That was fighting long enough to get air support.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Which I believe we talked about. So here you don't have that.
And in fact, the guys that we're looking at are the fire support. They're the heavy machine guns and sledges of mortar men. So those would be guys you call.
What was the reason why there was not more of a carrier presence in the area, given the need for air support that they did not have?
Well, a lot of it comes down to just the level of technology of the day. So, I mean, you know, you didn't have all of these really integrated systems. You didn't have really precise munitions for actually calling in direct close fire. The other side of it was that, especially as you got on later in the war, they kind of touch on it on Guadalcanal. They don't explain it well, but it's like part of the reason Guadalcanal took so long is because the Japanese Navy actually pushed out the U.S. Navy and stopped them from flying for a significant amount of time.
There's a bit of dialogue. There's a bit of dialogue exchange where they talk about how they ran off the Americans at one point.
Yeah, exactly. And that was a big part of what it was. So a lot of what I was actually just watching something, a great YouTube channel called The Operations Room. The carriers and the Navy were all often being tasked with trying to stop the Japanese from resupplying. And that was a big part of it. So it's like, if you could not only fight the Japanese on the island, but stopping them from cutting off. And there was still air support going on. They were hitting bigger emplacements and things like that. It wasn't quite as close and direct. You didn't have a lot of the modern like forward air controllers and things like that to actually call in really close strikes and things like that. So it was just kind of different. And I mean, again, some of it was also so small and so fast, it didn't matter. Like, I mean, again, I go to, you know, when they're on Peleliu, which just for the record had one of the highest Marine casualty rates of the entire war.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody is entirely sure exactly what the value of that island ended up being. But it's like that one is like when you're sitting in your foxhole and you can't, and even if you're your watch, you suddenly hear some guys fighting in the foxhole next to you. And it's because the Japanese have slipped between your lines in the middle of the night. And it's like, that's something you can't call on air support for. And it's just like the right. constant grind, the constant sensory overload. Like, you know, I've read things, I think, a book by Sebastian Younger called War, which talks about a place called the Korangal Valley. He gets into some of the science behind, you know, what we refer to as you know, post-traumatic stress disorder and operational stress injury. And it's about, right. you know, overloading cortisol and your adrenaline systems sure. and everything like that. That's
you're not meant to constantly be in fight or flight.
Yeah, exactly. And
that's the nature of being under fire is you're in fight or flight mode.
Yeah. Or potentially under fire. Is it yeah. even, you know, I think going into even talking about episode 4, I mean, there's a, oh, Mark, did I lose you? Oh, there you are.
Occasionally I have to mute my camera because I got to deal with something, but keep going.
No worries. But getting into like, you know, part 4, which is about Gloucester, a little bit around Pavuvu and Banica, like, you know, that again is Leckie just dealing with, I believe what they called combat stress at the time, like the terminology has changed. But it's just, you know, always being on that guard, always having that sensory overload. And even
I think it's important to illustrate what was being asked of these men.
Oh, for sure.
You know, because I think now with at least an elementary appreciation for post-traumatic stress disorder and other kinds of mental illness that will creep in for elongated deployment, that's how it is now. So you have shorter rotations. There's you're asked to do less as a soldier, which is not a slight against modern soldiering. It is an understanding of these people need to be returned to society at some point. It'd be best to not completely break them. But back in the 40s, you were asked as men to do things that today sound like torture. And it was, well, do you want to win or don't you? And a lot of the men of the time, I mean, individually, and some of the show somewhat deals with this, crumbled under the stress. But I think ideally they all wanted to be good boys and do the job they were being given. But you're talking, I mean, think about this. Because I not to draw sort of a stupid comparison, but I get frustrated with some of the adults in my life.
The wire.
I get frustrated with some of the adults in my life who the simple task of adulting is daunting and they don't want to do it and they crumble at the slightest inconvenience. And it's like, Christ almighty, these guys went for months, years in the field. And they, I mean, we're talking walking across islands here, you know, walking across cities, carrying, you know, 10s, 20, 30 pounds of gear, to be asked to fight in fields of battle and not have enough ammo, not have enough equipment, not have air support, and then stay there and do it all again for months on end.
Not have food, not have water.
That's a lot to ask. Yeah, not have food, not have water. I know people who, if they don't have lunch, like, I don't want to do my job anymore. I want to go home. Like, the fuck? Like, meanwhile, these guys were expected to conquer a country. And let's not run away from that idea. The job of the Marines in the Pacific was to conquer the Empire of Japan. And they were supposed to do so with shoestrings and bubblegum, essentially. It's a lot to ask. It's no wonder some of these guys, by the end of it, were just like, I am this close to fucking losing my mind.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't blame them.
Yeah, and I mean, I think on some level, I think they deal with that, you know, both with primary characters and with secondary characters, I think a great degree of sympathy. So, I mean, I think, do you remember the character of the gunnery sergeant that shows up fairly early on?
Mm-hmm.
He's the guy who, like, took a shower in the middle of the rain and was, like, just stripped naked and started scrubbing himself.
Right.
And he was the one that yelled at the officer. And it's like, I think by the second episode when they're on Peleliu, he, I don't want to say breaks, but he's exhausted.
Yeah.
Just after they lose the skipper. And it's like, even people who... you know, are trained and capable and are experienced can only take so much for so long.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes I don't it comes up at any given moment.
I don't think the Pacific is great, but I think it deals with that really well. Yeah. I think if there's one thing that you can hang on the Pacific and say this it accomplishes well, it how much being at war sucks. Because if you've ever watched any of these shows, it feels like, oh, it's kind of glorifies it just a little too much. Not the Pacific. The Pacific, I would say the Pacific wins the award for showing just how bad war actually is.
And you can see episode 9.
Yeah, without having seen episode 9. Something I wanted to ask you as we get to the second half of this podcast. And, you know, and again, if you have more notes and things you wanted to discuss, please just run ahead of me. But I am curious, does the show ever deal with the lines of logic that led to Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Not really. No, they very much keep it on a very, very insular to what the characters are. Okay. And maybe what I'll do actually is I do want to talk about episode 9 because I think that's a big one to deal with. So that's because, okay. So you stopped at 7. Let me just pull up my list here. Yeah. So you dealt with 7. So that would be Peleliu Hills, which again, yeah. So part eight was a good episode. And actually it was kind of interesting. Actually, one of my favorite scenes in the entire series is in part 8. So mm-hmm. that is very much following Barcelona back around. So he's back in the States. He's basically said, I'm done with going around and selling war bonds. I want to get back to the core. My enlistment's almost up. I want to start training guys again. So I said, okay, you're with 5th Marines. You're there. You get to see him meeting his eventual wife, who is also a Marine. She was part... I don't know if the Marines... There's something I honestly don't know. So in Commonwealth countries, they basically set up a separate women's force for every one of the branches. So you had, a women's army reserve, a women's air force group, and a women's naval group and things like that. I don't know if the Americans did the same or if it was just women members who were Marines at the time. So he had met her on base. You get to see him. He gets promoted up to gunnery sergeant. He starts training his own group of recruits to eventually go and fight in the Pacific. And I mean, it kind of is interesting because the show very, in some ways does kind of treat the Japanese as a third party to all this. I mean, they are the antagonist nominally and you don't get till 9 until you get to humanize them a little bit more, but there's also a moment where he's training his guys and like, he's getting them up at 4 a.m. He's making them do full rock marches and everything because he knows what he's been through. He knows what they need to be able to go through. And one of the guys who's a little bit of a hothead says, you know, I just want to, and pardon the phrasing, but I'm going to quote from the series, is I just want to slap a Jap. Kind of being very dismissive. And he goes on this beautiful rant just saying, the Japanese I know, the Japanese soldier will live on maggoty rice and everything to put you in your graves. So do not disrespect them. And it's kind of this interesting moment. And it ends with him actually getting killed on Iwo Jima, unfortunately. But, you know, that's kind of episode 8. And again, kind of shows that. And he had actually chosen that at that point he had trained these guys. He wanted to continue fighting with them because at the end of the day, he decided he was a Marine. He loved the Corps. And
modern audiences appreciate the level of intensity we were dealing with the enemy, because this wasn't the case with the German. The German army, in many cases, like just kind of like following orders and whatever else, and really didn't appreciate the scope of what was going on in Auschwitz and everything else, and was just sort of like, but they weren't suicidal, and the fucking Japanese, exactly. And you know, and like. We think about the word today, and I don't know how many people really appreciate what the inference here is, but kamikaze pilots, these are guys who when there was no other choices left, which is ram their plane into you. You know,
and it wasn't even no other choices left. It was that is what you're trained for now. Right. We don't have time to train you to actually fight people. We're just gonna train you how to take off, fly into a boat and leave. And that's it.
Yeah. It's a lot to ask of a guy.
In context, you know what the phrase kamikaze actually means?
What?
It means divine wind. So it actually goes back to a storm in Japanese history. So, I mean, this was very much, and maybe I'm being overly, maybe slightly hyperbolic, but it's like, this was almost a religious war in a lot of ways.
Yes. No, I don't think you're being hyperbolic at all.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there was a definite level of, oh, go ahead.
Think of it this way. Leaving out the racial component, because you can't not factor in, we didn't drop the atomic bomb on Berlin. We dropped it on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. But leaving that out, because that's a whole other discussion. It's a bit touchy.
You finish up and then I'll bring some in real quick.
Yeah, leaving out the racial component, the prejudice therein. To get to the point where we're like, make me an invention, do it before the Germans do it, but make me an invention that sets the atmosphere on fire. Like, I want to be able to blow up a city in one shot. Do that, because it's the only way we're going to convince these people to stop. And I remember like listening to one of my history professors talk about how the Japanese would have kept fighting. Like, the leadership thought this is going to end badly. Like, I don't know what got into the Americans all of a sudden, but they have decided that genocide, was the way to go. And we'd like to continue being Japanese people, so let's stop. But the hoi polloi, the Japanese military, would have kept going despite that. And I think the show does the best job it can of illustrating that the Americans were really up against an almost unbeatable, in terms of will, military.
I'll put it in perspective for you. So this is a story that goes around, and I think this is probably the most accurate version. So on Guadalcanal, where the first battle happened, there was a Japanese lieutenant who got separated from his unit. He didn't surrender until 1949.
I was actually thinking about that when we first started.
They had to have a member of the Japanese military show up and convince him that the war was over.
Right.
Like, that's how...
Weren't there soldiers sitting on, like, islands that didn't know the war was over? Like, they, like, you know, like, for years didn't realize the war was over.
No, I'd say that's pretty accurate. I mean, I think you're very much on point with that conversation around the racial issue. I mean, one of my professors actually put it in ways where it's like, on some level, the Second World War was a series of race wars.
Sure.
And the war between the Americans and the Japanese could be argued to be one of those. I mean, we even went in and in one of my courses pulled up a lot of the old Looney Tunes cartoons that were shown as propaganda during the war and things like that. And I mean, it was, some of the language just kind of made you blanch. From Bugs Bunny, for Christ's sakes. But anyway.
Bugs Bunny nips the nips.
Yes. Oh, no. That wasn't even the worst one that we saw. But I won't repeat it here because, I mean, I think, you know, you separate. That's why I tend to use the phrase Imperial Japanese. Like, I actually have some Japanese relatives.
Mm-hmm.
And they were actually here before the war. And a couple of the members were actually in. So Canada also had internment camps and they were interned.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, you know, you've got to separate that element. I mean,
the stuff that Japanese did to China, there's a tendency in liberal America and I don't know about liberal Canada, but in liberal America, there's a tendency. And Robert and I have talked about this late. I talked a little bit about actually with Alexis today. America is just the worst at everything. Everything America does is the worst. Everything, you know, everything America ever did is worse than any other country. And I'm like, you can look at a lot of things that happened in the American slavery. Years. You can look at a lot of what this country has done to its black people, even in during Reconstruction. Have you talked to the Chinese lately? Because what the Japanese did to them makes the shit we did to the blacks in this country look like nothing. Like the horrors of, from what I've read, the horrors of what the Japanese internment camps, in terms of like what they did to the Chinese, is just. I wouldn't even go as far as say borderline. Yeah. Like, it's just inhumane.
Oh yeah, and then sorry, when I say internment, I mean people who were living in people of Japanese descent who was living in North America were interned.
No, no, I understood that. Yeah. It bears repeating because yeah, the Rape of Nanking. Yeah, it bears repeating because again, you talk to a lot of people today, and a lot of this history. So it's a joke about, like, you know, if you turn 50, suddenly you have this weird interest in World War II. Like, I don't know how many people in their 20s and 30s are actively having discussions about what we were up against. I mean, they called World War I the war to end all wars. Then we did it again just to make sure we got it right. And I don't know how many people appreciate how close to the end of the world it was, you know, and the savagery that took place among men. Because we think about, like, Abu Ghraib, called it Abu Ghraib-ass.
Yep.
But, you know, like, we think about what happened in the Middle East and the inhumane treatment and all of that. And I'm like, oof. you have not paid too close attention to what happened in World War II.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so I kind of almost want to move on to 9 a little bit, episode 9, just talk about that, sure. Because that's where you really start to get into some of the questions around kind of dehumanizing, and particularly what they do to Sledge. So Sledge is that character who does, and Okinawa was bad. To this point, you really didn't see a lot of civilians in the war because they mm-hmm. were small, fairly sparsely populated islands. Okinawa has been around, it was a kingdom for, you know, 500 years. It's where karate comes from. That's what it's known. And Okinawa is a distinctly different place from Japan, like culturally, linguistically, everything like that. But of course, the Japanese had annexed it, and this was kind of the first part of the Japanese islands, even though that's inaccurate, that the Americans took. And when the Japanese went in there and when they started defending against the Americans, they press ganged thousands upon thousands of Okinawan civilians into defense forces and things like that. And they turned them into suicide bombers, and they used them as human shields and everything like that. And you can just see as it goes and goes and goes, how much it just wears on Sledge and what that mm-hmm. character goes through. And yeah, I don't necessarily want to get into trying to, you know, relay all the little incidents that it shows, because one, I don't think it does it justice, and two, it just feels like it'll go on for too long. But it's a hard watch, and even for me, who's you know, read and studied a lot of this shit, because I think they do a good job of portraying that, and I think they actually do give some more humanity to some characters who are not American necessarily. But I mean, it goes to this whole idea of what's going on with the dehumanization of all of these characters, and they go on, and that really kind of comes to a head in episode 10, where as opposed to, you know, Band of Brothers, where they just had kind of the voiceover and everyone's still in Germany, and then you hear what they do afterwards, you actually get to see everyone come home. So you get to see Sledge come home, you get to see Lecky come home, you get to see a little bit of, there's a wonderful scene with Bassalone's wife actually going to see his parents and everything like that, and she's Italian too, so there's kind of a quick cultural acceptance there. But it's like, you know, you see Lecky come home and he goes right back to work there, trying to get his life back together. He reconnects with Vera, who's the girl next door that he had said he would write to and things like that. And there's actually a lot of really great scenes.
that line in the beginning. So I try to not to project as much and be as bitter sounding on this podcast these days. But I listened to that exchange. I was keyed into the very first episode. He's like, "Hey, I've joined the Marines." She's like, "Oh, good." Like, "I'll write you." Okay. Not every woman was like that. Not every exchange between a man and a woman went that way. But that one struck me. It was an interesting decision, narratively, dramatically, to have a guy say to a pretty girl that he likes, "I'm going to do my bit to save the world," and her not seemingly giving a shit. Bold choice.
No, exactly. But I mean, you kind of miss out if you don't see the last episode, because he actually does go back and see her and everything like that, and actually reveals that he actually did.
Is she less of a twat the second time around? Is she less of a twat the second time around?
Oh, no. Actually, the stuff they have is really sweet, where he goes over to see her and he finds out that he finds out that she's actually going out with a with like a new officer recruit, and he's a little rude to, or the officer's a little rude to her. So she's like, you know what, you can definitely go take me out to dinner and stuff like that. And they reconnected. And as you find out, they actually got married and lived a very long and happy life together. So you also find out that he did in fact write her during the entire Pacific, but he was always afraid to send her the letters because he was honestly convinced he'd never make it out.
Given that theater of war, I don't blame him.
Yeah, exactly. Like he wrote them, and then, and I think he said the rains in Gloucester basically tore them all up and everything like that. And she said, "Was it good?" And he said, "The best stuff I ever wrote." It's actually a really great scene. And then maybe again, I'll talk a little bit more about Sledge. So he comes back. He goes back to his parents' house. He runs into his buddy Sid, who he finds out is getting married. Mm-hmm. Refuses to, and he has trouble adjusting because he went through a lot. Like he goes, you know, I guess there's a big ball in Alabama that you know, they try and go to, and he's like, I will not wear a uniform or anything like that. He tries to go on and enlist, or not enlist, but, you know, sign up for college courses. And the girl who's taking everything, all of his information there, is very well to do, but she asks these questions like, so did the Army teach you any, or did the Marines teach you any, you know, technical skills or anything like that? And he leans into her and it's like, they taught me how to kill the enemy, and I was really good at it. I mean, it's kind of funny, but it's like the way he also plays it is there, which reminds me, there is the one fact I have to bring up around that one. The guy who played Eugene Sledge, Joseph, look at me, I'm looking at the back of the DVD box as opposed to just pulling up. I want to say it's Marzatello.
Keep going.
Anyway. This one's going to be a fun one for everyone. He's the kid from Jurassic Park.
Oh, interesting.
Mazzello. Yes. Joseph Mazzello. So he played Tim in Jurassic Park. So, but anyway, I mean, he has moments like towards the end of the episode, like he goes out hunting with his dad and just drops his gun and just breaks down. And his father, and there's scenes of him, like the other one that happens is, his brother, who I think was an armored officer, is there, and they start sharing a little bit around not being able to sleep. So, I mean, they try and, you know, definitely compassionately address what dealing with things like, you know, an operational stress injury or PTSD is like on some level. Not complete by any way, but at least sympathetic.
All right. Anything else you wanted to address before we call it a night?
Let me just think. I think that's probably it.
Okay.
But yeah, it's definitely it's a different show. I think it actually reflects the nature of that war well. It's not quite as TV friendly. It doesn't dramatically hang together quite as well as Band of Brothers, but I mean, still well worth a watch.
Yeah, I think if you're a war TV enthusiast, it's worth a watch. I mean, it certainly has its credits. That's the one thing I wanted to talk about before we got out of here was it was nominated and won a whole bunch of awards, the major ones, the Primetime Emmys. It won Outstanding Miniseries. It was nominated for Outstanding Directing for a Miniseries and Outstanding Writing for a Miniseries. It was the 2010 Primetime Creative Arts Emmy. It won Outstanding Art Direction. It won Outstanding Casting. It won Outstanding Makeup, Outstanding Prosthetic Makeup. It won for Outstanding Sound Editing, which that I can believe.
Yeah. Also, hey, casting, you got Rami Malek in there. You got Bernthal.
Yeah. It's got Outstanding Sound Mixing. And then Outstanding Special Visual Effects. Like I said, it won a bunch more awards. See if there's anything from the... Oh, it won a... was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Miniseries. It did not win. It won some Golden Reels. So, I mean, it's definitely, like I said, I think it earns its place among the better wartime shows. Not one of my favorites, but definitely worth a conversation, definitely worth a watch, and I'm glad you recommended it to me.
Thank you. I'm interested to see, especially after when we have this conversation around, you know, the somewhat disconnected nature of the show, how Masters of the Year is going to go, because that one's already really clearly looking like it's going to be following a couple of different units. Like, I think they're going to be looking at like some of the fighter squadrons and a lot of time with the bomber squadrons and things like that. And again, that's a whole lot of territory to cover, both literally and figuratively. So I'm interested to see how they're going to structure that one.
All right. Well, folks, it's been a fun week here on the Rattle Legend Broadcasting Network. One of the more full weeks that we've had for a while. I went twice today, plus I recorded Monday and Tuesday, so I had a busy week. Monday, we did Wish. It was myself, Good Boy, Zachary Strobel, Alexis Haina, and Robert Winfrey. And Third Time's a Charm, myself and Jason Teasley looked at the Lake Placid series. We had a very fun, loosey-goosey discussion. Alexis Haina and Dorian Price reviewed Thanksgiving, not the holiday, the movie. Earlier today, myself and Alexis Haina had a really great conversation regarding Upload. Definitely worth a listen. You know, it's funny. I never know sometimes how these shows are going to go. You know, sometimes I go into them like, oh, I'm not going to have a lot to say here. You know, we're gonna end up like hurting for content. And if I didn't have to cut the conversation short and go get my kids, I think Alexis and I would still be talking. Like, it was a really, really good conversation today for Upload Season 3. And then you just heard me, myself, and Andrew talk the Pacific. Mostly Andrew, big star you are. Next week, we've got No Bananas. We've got The Killers and Pain Hustlers on Damn You Hollywood. We've got The Plot Against America, The Last Stop on the Corner to the Deuce. And then my son will be joining Alexis Haina and Andrew Orozco from Geek News Network to discuss Scott Pilgrim Takes Off, the cartoon on Netflix. So go ahead and check those out. I am at Mark Rattledge on Twitter. Or X, as the cool kids call it. More importantly, I am at Mark Rattles on TikTok, where at this point, like, it's just becoming a place for my son to practice his comedy. Today, he did a bit. He legit got a jelly donut, and there was no jelly in his donut, and he did a solid minute about this. It was quite funny. He's got some comedic chops, that one. Andrew, what else are you on? What else did you want us to tell the people about?
Well, first thing I'm going to tell everyone to go ahead and definitely listen to Mark and Jesse when they talk about The Plot Against America, because God damn it, Mark, I've told you offline. I'm going to tell the internet right now. I think the whole Corner of the Deuce thing's been one of the best things we've done on this entire network. I genuinely mean that. It's been solid conversations every time. Really, really good content. Really, you know, thoughtful discussions of a lot of things. I'm looking forward to seeing how it ends.
Well, I appreciate that. I've had a lot of fun doing it. I'm glad I suggested it to Jesse. It's been one of the real highlights of the last 2 years, considering everything else that's happened. You'll be back January 4th, you and presumably David, to talk The Crown Season 6, and I hear you have thoughts.
This thing might be jumping the shark. It might legitimately be going off the rails right now. The first half was something. They made choices.
This is it, right? This is the end?
This is the end, so we will see what happens. But I'm in a lot of worry after the first four episodes of this season. So
how did Alicia handle it?
Oh, she's on the same boat as me. She's like, "What the hell was that?"
Oh, good. I can't wait.
The last episode makes I kind of almost want you to go. I know you like to watch everything right before we watch. I almost want you to watch the first four episodes just so I can get the message of Andrew. What the fuck just happened?
Okay, I'll work on that.
Okay, I'll mark January 5th on my calendar and make sure that I make it for that one.
January 4th.
Perfect. Other than that, you know what? I'm going to do some book plugs, so definitely go check out With the Old Breed. Second World War by Anthony Bieber. Bieber, not Bieber, wrong one. But the other one I'll also say is they actually did a book version of The Pacific that tells a bunch of other stories around other really interesting guys in the Pacific. They cover a guy who worked with a bunch of Filipino guerrillas against the Japanese. They deal with a dive bomber pilot. That book was written by, I believe, Hugh Ambrose, who was the son of the gentleman who wrote Band of Brothers originally. So that's actually a really worthwhile book to go track down. I had it at some point, but I think I gave it away. And other than that, I do train at Esteem and Havoc Martial Arts here in Calgary. My instructor is Jay Cooper, and you can go check him out doing his Reality Check series over on YouTube and various other platforms via the Budo Brothers, who is a fantastic local martial arts brand, and they offer a couple of great training courses, including his extended reality check training course that you can check out as well.
All right, folks, thank you for joining us on our Veterans Day show. For Andrew Graham, I'm Mark Rattledge. Sir coughs a lot. Be well, be safe, and behave.